Some of us are not fortunate enough to have jobs that we love. Peter Gibbons is a result of what happens when you don't motivate your coworkers enough to try their very best. At least that's what the Bobs told us during an interview. Office Space is a movie about what happens when you care so little about your job that you're willing to risk it all to get a little money at the end. Dare I say, fractions of a penny to be exact. Being a true cult classic that came out in 1999, does the Office Space movie hold up? Let's not jump to conclusions in that beautiful map, because we're going to be talking about that exciting movie right here on A Cast of the Past, where you can check out a brand new episode each and every Sunday talking about the movies, the video games, whether they be good or they be bad. We experienced them through the 90s, 2000s, or sometimes we go all the way back to the 80s and we watch them for the very first time. My name is Juan Velez. I am from Puerto Rico, and joining me as always, first we have from Boston, Massachusetts, Mr. Ryan McNulty. Now, Ryan, this is a movie from Mike Judge, and some people like his stuff. Some people don't quite get it. Where do you fall in that side of the fence?
I would say I fall somewhere in the middle. I'm a huge fan of Office Space. Growing up, I know King of the Hill was one of his big shows, signature shows, and along with Beavis and Butthead. Beavis and Butthead I liked a lot growing up just because it was super immature comedy. But King of the Hill, it was something it took a little bit more for me to appreciate. As I got a little bit older, I started to understand it a little bit more. When I watched it as a kid, I don't think I fully grasped everything that was going on. But I've come to appreciate those a lot more as time's gone on.
And with that being said, from London, Ontario, we have Keith McKenzie Poshick. Now, Keith,
that's me.
Are you a fan of movies and shows that focus on everyday problems? And I ask this because we talked about The Breakfast Club previously, and you didn't quite love that type of movie. So is that just not your thing, or was Breakfast Club just an exception to the rule?
If it's relatable, I guess I fall in line with it, because if you present me with that question, my answer is immediately to say no. But at the same time, there are aspects of this movie that hit home in a way that I'm like, yeah, okay, this would kill me on the inside as well. So there are exceptions, but I don't know, I'm still of the mind that if I'm going to sit down and watch something for 2 hours, maybe it should be a little more fantastical than the everyday dealings that I can go outside and experience.
Yeah, now, it's worth pointing out that for me, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. I think that if we had a conversation about what is your comfort food movie, you know, it's that movie that whenever you're going to clean the house or something like that, you always put it in the background. I've watched The Office Space easily over 15 times. Like, it is one of the only movies that I can quote. Like, I usually can't quote stuff, and you guys know that. Like, I'm just bad at movie references, but from The O Face to The Case of the Mondays, like, I say these things in a regular part of my life, and I don't even think about that. So, did you guys watch this movie back in the day, or when is the first time that you watched it, starting with Ryan?
I've seen this movie plenty of times. It was a Comedy Central staple for quite a while, and I think that's where I first saw it. I remember seeing the trailers for this movie, but never saw it in theaters. And then basically when it became that, and like Joe Dirt became the recurring Comedy Central movies that are just kind of always on every single Sunday, it just kind of fell into my repertoire. And the more I see this movie, the more I seem to enjoy it. I feel like most people won't fully, even though it's not like a hard movie to understand, I don't think it can be fully appreciated upon only one viewing. It seems to be the more you view it, the more you seem to appreciate it.
For me, it was the first time watching it, it was yesterday. And I understand what you're saying from that, Ryan, where it's really hard to fully appreciate it from one view, because after watching it for the first time less than 24 hours ago, I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, okay, I guess I can see why this is a cult classic. Eh.
I'm hurting right now.
I'm not going to lie, Juan. I'm going to warn you that this might be a tough hour and a half for our relationship.
I know. Like, the moment that we talked about this episode on the Discord, my first thought was, oh boy, this is gonna hurt, because it's interesting.
The first time I feel like I have good reasoning. I feel like I can justify myself well.
I'm interested in hearing your arguments here, but I remember the first time that I saw this, I was a kid, and it must have been a VHS rental. And I don't know why I liked it, because, and I guess Ryan and me are the only real two people that can have this conversation. Like, the first one is that this is a movie about adult life. Mm-hmm. So having it watched it as a kid for the first time, it's like, why did I like it? Like, I really don't know, because it's all about like driving to work and the annoying parts of work. I don't know if I was just fascinated by that, because as a kid, maybe I thought to myself, like, wow, like, I can imagine, you know, when I eventually get to work, like, I'm going to have a group of coworkers. I'm going to have one that's really dull and the other one that's like overly active and enthusiastic. And I'm doing a podcast with Ryan and Keith. I'm not going to say who's Michael, who's Samir, who's Peter. We can talk about that later. But Ryan, in your case, like, having watched it so many times, what has been the one thing about the movie that's always been the same that you liked? And then what has sort of evolved as you became an adult and had adult responsibilities?
So I think the big thing that appealed to me was I love Peter's attitude when he has that moment after his like hypnotherapy, where he just kind of lives that dream of anyone who's got the regular 9-to-5, how he's just like completely just disregards it all, just does whatever he wants. Like, one of my favorite conversations when he's talking to Joanna in the restaurant, and he's just like, yeah, I just don't think I'm going to go anymore. Like, you know, I don't want to work. I would rather just do nothing. And I think that aspect of, I knew my what lies ahead of me in my future when I was younger, that I'm going to have to work a job and all this. And just tapping into that fantasy of like, what if I could just do whatever I wanted? What if I'm not tied to this kind of life on the rails that everybody has to follow? And then getting older and entering the working world, working in offices, you really relate to, you know, granted, they turn up things to 11 of how bad office life can be, but you can relate to so much of that. Having multiple people tell you about a mistake that it's like, yeah, I know, I fixed it. Like that kind of lack of communication, just the mundaneness of like, you know, oh, it's Hawaiian shirt day. Like, yay, you're still miserable, but you're wearing a Hawaiian shirt. You
exactly.
know,
exactly. Life just is a balance.
Tapping into all those things that you, once you work in an office, you appreciate all of that, you know, 10 times more.
So just to be clear, the movie is about Peter Gibbons and his group of friends that are also coworkers. And they have a job, like they have stable jobs. Like, it's not like, you know, they're desperate for a change or something. But Peter is kind of just fed up with stuff. Like, he really doesn't care if he has a job or not. He has some relationship problems as well, which leads to him going to therapy with his girlfriend at the time, that everybody suspected that she was cheating on him. But the most insane thing happens, which is that as he's getting therapy, the therapist is in the middle of having a heart attack. Just, who, like, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
So he has Peter in a trance, right? So he's like super chill, super relaxed. But then as the therapist is about to have him snap out of the trance, he literally has the heart attack. He dies. So then everybody's in there panicking. That's easily one of my top five favorite scenes in the movie. Like, there's a dude dying, and then Peter's just like breathing deeply, just like shrugging his shoulders, like, hey, dude, you taking a nap down there or something like that? And then temporarily, he just, it's not that he doesn't care about stuff, it's that he does what he really cares about, which is nothing. Doing absolutely nothing. That's his goal, and he gets to live that throughout the beginning parts of the movie. But as he snaps out, then everything unfolds. He figures out that, hey, you know, we're programmers. Maybe we can do a little something to get some money out of the company, fractions of a penny. Things
spiral out of control. Yeah, as he realizes his friends are going to be laid off, which is what motivates it.
Yeah, because they're going to be downsizing, which is another real thing. I mean, this happened in 1999. This is something that is incredibly relevant, you know, today. You see all these huge companies doing massive downsizing because of tech advances and things like that. So Keith, as the person that I know you definitely enjoyed this movie the least as a whole, what did you think about the actual concept of, like, here's these guys that some are going to be fired, one guy's just kind of tired of life, And then they're just trying to get creative about how can they make a little bit of money.
I do really like the concept of the movie because they do such a great job laying out just how mundane everything about it is from the second it starts in that opening traffic scene. As somebody that's been there can super relate to that, and it's the most miserable existence on the planet. But they do such a good job of that, that the fantastical part of it that separates it from a movie like The Breakfast Club that you mentioned in that trance really stands out as something that it's a bit of a fun ride to go on, just because everybody wishes they could just, you know, if they have to work a weekend, just tell your boss, oh, screw it, I don't really feel like going. So it does do a really good job with that, and then the plot that it creates afterwards as he slowly gets out of it and comes up with a plan, because hey, it's a movie, everybody needs to have a big plan, and it makes sense on like, this plan is so mundane that it fits in the mundane world around it.
And one of my favorite things, as you mentioned with the traffic at the beginning, is that they very quickly lay out the different characters. Like Michael is listening to rap music, but then he's like afraid of saying the N-word in the car. So, you know, like he'll lower the music. And more so than the type of music, I think that, and I don't know if you guys relate, and I would love to know, whenever you're in your car by yourself, that's when you're the most you. Because you're insulated, yeah. Nobody's listening to you, you're getting from point A to point B, so the odds of, you know, you stumbling upon somebody that knows you is very small. Like, how amazing is that driving experience for you, sense the traffic?
I've been that person at least 1,000 times in my life, with the music up, singing the top of my lungs. Maybe not like Tupac or anything like that, but I've definitely been there. My car is basically a one-man karaoke station when I'm driving by myself.
Yeah, I think you're right in the way that when you're driving somewhere and it's just you, you're kind of just stuck with your thoughts. So you get
for
bored
better or
and
worse.
you either like just sing or talk something out, whatever. But you're just kind of in your own head. So like you said, Juan, you're definitely more you than almost any other time, because you're just kind of stuck with you're stuck with yourself, and you gotta keep yourself amused.
So something else we gotta mention is that this movie didn't come out of nowhere, because even though it came out in 1999, this is actually based on the Milton shorts that came out all the way earlier in 1991. So these were Saturday Night Live shorts, and when I watched the movie, I didn't even know this existed. So Milton is one of the characters in the movie, but he's a supporting character. He's a play by Stephen Root, which, I mean, I thought that was the actor. Like, I thought he wasn't acting. I thought it was somebody that actually had some challenges, but then I saw him in another movie. I'm like, damn, you're a good-ass actor.
Because yeah, he was in Dodgeball, right?
Yeah. So, had you guys ever watched or even knew about the Milton shorts from 1991?
The shorts definitely sound familiar. I can't remember if I ever actually watched a full one or not, but I remember hearing about it.
Yeah, I know they exist, but I don't think I've seen them, because I couldn't tell you one if you asked me right now, but I know they exist.
They're actually pretty good. They are about Milton and Lumberg, and pretty much most of the scenes that you see between them in the movie are taken directly from the shorts, like as far as like having to move the desk and, you know, the stapler, little things like that. So I love the fact that almost a decade later, they made a movie about that actually blends the characters in, and even the character Lumberg, which for those who don't know, he's the boss. He's one of the bosses, right? Because there's a ton of bosses in this company, but the actor playing him does such an incredible job at having that slow tone. And
yeah.
Doesn't that just get to your nerves? And I get that's exactly the point, but have you guys ever had somebody in your life that speaks at such a different pace that you kind of just want to like super kick him in the face or something?
Jesus, no.
Oh, really?
Not at all.
Okay, that is just me.
No, not to the point where I'd want to super kick someone in the face. That's a little
extreme. How about a power bomb? No?
No, that's even worse.
Just somebody that you don't like. How about that?
Well, I mean, there's tons of people that I don't like, but it's not because of the way they talk.
Okay. So What about Lumbergh as a whole? Did you think that his character added a lot to the movie just based on the fact that he's just so dramatically different compared to everybody else?
Mm-hmm. Lumbergh was Lumbergh. An aspect of this movie
Lumbergh.
That
get
I
get it right. Lumbergh is another thing.
Lumbergh, Lumbergh, Lumbergh. Lumbergh is an aspect of this movie that I think was that society was made detrimental because he's been quoted so much. I don't think I got the full experience because I've seen it in 2019. Just knowing, like, God, I've probably seen 100,000 memes of,
yeah,
if you could do this, that'd be great. And just knowing all that, it kind of took away from the experience a little bit for me. And there's a few aspects of the movie that did that.
Yeah, I mean, it's that movie has been so popular that it's really embedded into culture. So if you didn't see it kind of early on, I guess some of it gets kind of spoiled just because it's, you know, so prevalent to this day. But yeah, Lumbergh is just such an iconic character in this movie. And he's probably the best supporting role in the way that it would just not be the same movie without him because he's so perfectly boring and infuriating. And it's just, he really plays an amazing villain that's just so subtly done, but also over the top. It's just a weird mix, you know?
Mm-hmm. He's the idea of the movie wrapped up into a human being, where the tone of the movie is very slow, mundane, boring, and aggravating. And those are the words that I would describe that character with as well.
So going all the way back to after the traffic, the biggest thing in the movie up to that point is the keys of the Mondays, which anybody that has a standard 9-to-5 job sort of knows what we're talking about, right? It's like the beginning of the week. This is when you're catching up with your coworkers. Some of them.
If there's something that I'd like to super kick somebody for is if somebody goes up to me and says, "Ooh, case of the Mondays, so, eh?"
First of all, that is insane. A really Canadian response to that. Second of all, has that been a thing for you guys? Like, have you ever had such a bad Monday that, I'm not saying they told you straight up case of the Mondays, but somebody just goes like, "Hey, you had a good weekend, not so much of a great first day." Like, have you had anything like that?
The phrase, "Ugh, Mondays, am I right?" or something along those lines has just been said way too many times in my life.
Yeah, I mean, nothing to that degree, and no one's ever been that, like, said it directly to me, but it's just kind of that common, like, "Oh, it's only Monday," or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just that kind of common misery, I think, is more something I run into than someone coming up to me like, "Oh, case of the Mondays."
But that's what I loved about the movie, because think about the fact that that's at the very beginning. Usually, that is, like, the last thing that you want to have, because, like, what you sort of mentioned, Ryan, Mondays is like the most boring day of the week, because it's like the one day you don't maybe want to be at work. Maybe you had an awesome Sunday. So why would you start the movie with that? But then that's when the rumor mill starts that, hey, you know, they may be possibly doing some downsizing, or, you know, we're already having a rough morning. Or the biggest thing here is that.
Well, it also makes a lot of sense that the movie starts on a Monday, like the start of the work week. So I think that really does kind of fit. And that the whole first couple scenes of the movie are really just to show how miserable Peter is at his job, you know, commuting to work, being at work, you know, when he's with the hypnotherapist or whatever, he's basically saying, like, every day is the worst day of his life. Like, it only gets worse.
Jesus.
It's rough.
So it's like when you're talking to him, he's having the worst day of his life. So they really go out of their way to just put every single thing that annoys him. You know, you have the secretary putting a bunch of people on hold. He's got 8 different people telling him about his TPS reports that he didn't put, you know,
volume.
"Did you get the memo? You know, we'll send you another copy of the memo," all that stuff. So I think that's just part of it, is they wanted to throw everything at you about and, like, really emphasize how miserable
Keith, could
he
you
is.
Try Milton voice? Could you just do it? Come on, man. The beginning part, the reasonable volume. Just say reasonable volume in a Milton voice. It'll make me so happy and everybody.
Reasonable volume?
I believe you're
listening to my radio at a reasonable volume.
Big grains of salt.
I did not receive my
and
paycheck.
Now, the next 30 minutes of the podcast is us doing Milton voices.
Just doing
30 minutes later.
I was told I could have it in a reasonable volume from 9 to 11.
Oh, just such a good character.
Okay, I think it's rage time. I'm going to be honest. I didn't like Milton.
But aren't you supposed to not like him?
You feel bad for him.
Well, it's not even that feel bad for him. Like, to me, he felt out of place in that movie, where he was just there for a little giggle. And maybe that's another one of those things that, because society has beaten that character to death, basically, with the stapler line, that it just felt very out of place in the movie. And I shouldn't say that I don't like Milton. I didn't like Milton in that movie, where it just felt like he was there to be there. And it makes a lot of sense, especially knowing the background of the SNL bits, that it felt very thrown in there. Like, it was, oh, okay, we have this great movie, but we also have this, so let's make the two combined. And then I guess it kind of ties all together at the end in a very, very extreme way, but I just don't think that he fit in the movie to, like, other than to be there for a few laughs.
So I watched this with my girlfriend, and this is the first time she's actually ever seen the movie. She said she liked it. She didn't think it was like it like blew her away or anything, which makes sense. And I think that's probably kind of where Keith's coming from too, because there's a lot of hype around it when it's really, it's kind of just like a very average movie that just is so memorable and it's just so iconic. But I could see someone coming in who's never seen it would be like, this is what the hype's all about. Like, it's just kind of a average movie. She actually really liked Milton. She felt bad for him the whole time. She had a lot of sympathy for him. So she was actually happy to see him, like, burn down the building at the end. I think my only criticism of the Milton thing because I've seen this movie so many times, but I'm usually watching it, like, out of order a lot. I'll just kind of come in halfway through and stuff. But watching it all the way through for the first time in a while, I think they were a little too on the nose with, like, the burning down the building thing, where he keeps mentioning it multiple times. I think it would have been a little bit better if he didn't say it so many times.
Yeah,
you know?
It just came out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if he never said he was going to burn down the building and he's just like, that's the last straw, and then you see the thing on fire and then he's walking away, then I think that would have been a little bit better, but just a minor.
So, just
criticism.
In case, he actually does the same thing in the 1991 short. So, like, he'll actually tell Lumberg, like, I'm going to burn the building down. So, I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that they tried to be as faithful as possible to the character. But going back to your point, Keith, I think we talked about this in the Breakfast Club episode. And I think this is going to naturally happen whenever we do a cult classic review, as opposed to, like, Titanic or something, which is that we forget what a cult classic is, because cult classics nowadays have become almost mainstream. Because the moment you get a Funko Pop or something, it's like 50 people are not buying your thing. You know, you can get Office Space Funko Pops yet, and that's one of the trivia things. Like, this movie bombed hard when it came out because it had a budget of $10 million and it made $12 million. So it only made $2 million more than what the movie cost. So when we define a cult classic, like, what I liked about the movie is that it wasn't trying to change the world. The whole purpose of the movie is that, hey, this is a 9-to-5 when it kind of sucks, but at the same time, you have some cool coworkers by your side, and maybe you plot. It's like, you even though you're irrelevant in the company, they know how to mess the company up if they wanted it to happen. So when Samir and Michael are about to be let go, it's like, hey, why not try this? You know, why not do that? But I get your point that when you watch it now, people blow it so much out of proportion that you mentioned it. It's like, it's not even the movie's problem. It's that everybody loves to talk about what was a cult classic and is no longer, in many ways, a cult classic. It's just a mainstream hit. It just happened decades later or something like that. You lose the magic that people had when they first discovered it. Like, does that make sense to you?
Yeah,
I agree 100%. And that's why I was kind of left after this movie thinking to myself, like, how do I fairly critique this? Because I don't have that magic behind it. I'm going at it in a way that society has basically beaten it to death, at least
the portions of
that
movie.
It really is. And the closest comparison that I could think of really for myself is, because I feel a lot of the ways that you feel about this movie, about Arrested Development, where it's a thing that bombed very hard when it was on TV, and people have really found it in the last few years. And that, you say what you will about the Netflix series, but that original run has become a cult classic in the same way that Office Space has. And I think in a lot of ways, it suffers from that same thing now, because there's aspects of it that have just been beaten to death that it's very hard to look at with fresh eyes just because of what society has done with it. I make it sound like society has like done this terrible thing to it, but there's
so much hype surrounding it, and then for you to come in and just see, you know, it is an like it is in a lot of ways
it's
just
right.
an average movie. Yeah, so it's like, is it fair to say you didn't hate it, you just don't love it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't hate this movie at all. I think it's just a very good middle of the road movie that, looking back at it, hard to understand at this point in 2019, hard to understand where the hype came from, just because it's so, the hype train is so far down the railroad tracks that it's impossible to keep up with at this point.
I think that what many people loved about the movie, and I want to get Ryan's feedback about this first, is that when you look at the premise is super normal. It is so normal. It's like Napoleon Dynamite. I think you can make a lot of comparisons to this and that, but everything that happens in the movie is so ridiculous, because on one side, it's a 9-to-5, but then a therapist dies, and then he's still in a trance, right? Like, whether that's possible or not, you know, he gets told to come in on a Saturday, but doesn't. So, keep him, like, consider the fact that this big scene consists of just a guy not waking up and not picking up his phone and his boss calling him. And that is such a basic scene. Like, Keith could easily grab his phone and record the same scene in his house in 2019. Like, there's next to no production
value.
He's
got to find an answering machine.
Yeah, I mean, that is my first problem.
Yeah, so maybe we'd have to modernize it just a little bit. But the entire movie is about that. Even at the very end, when Milton lights the entire place on fire, it's ridiculous. And at no point did you ever think, probably, like, oh yeah, he's going to actually set it on fire. And the fact that these three programmers just have this plot that they even mentioned, oh yeah, this is kind of like from Superman, right? We're doing the Superman thing with the computers. Mm-hmm. And then they actually
do it.
Has
anyone actually seen Superman 3, by the way? I haven't.
I've watched it when I was a kid. I can't
Do
even
you remember
tell you
that
anything
aspect
about it
at all. Was
Not
somebody
at all.
Trying? Okay.
I know I saw it, but I honestly
we'll just
can't
assume
tell
it's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I will say that I did appreciate that aspect of the movie, not knowing what I was getting into. It's like this slow, gradual incline of weird situations where halfway through it, I'm just sitting there like, okay, I guess this is a heist movie now. Sure, why not? Let's see what you got.
And then it's like three nobodies, right? And they have like slow motion scenes. And I know we're leading up to easily maybe Ryan and myself as a favorite scene. Okay, actually, no. I'm going to pause Ryan and me because I think that's going to be easy. Keith, what would you say is the most impressive or most enjoyable scene for you in the movie?
That's a tough one, really. Thinking about one that stands out.
Or just one that got a really good reaction out of you.
One that I really enjoyed, but it was mostly just because I hated the character so much, but this was good hate, was when Chickadee's guy, whatever his name was, got his comeuppance. Tchotchkes, that's it.
Chickadee's.
Chickadee guy got his comeuppance in the parking lot, and he kind of got told off. That was such a good scene. Because, God, I hate that character. That's the type of human being that I just want to break their face.
Yeah, so for context, that in the movie, we've talked about the three main characters, but then there's a fourth one that is involved as well, played by Jennifer Aniston, the character Joanna, who is a waitress. Joanna, who's a waitress at Tchotchkes. Damn, Keith and I are tied.
Lombard, Ryan, and Joanna.
Yeah, you got to mess up a name at some point, Ryan, during this episode.
This is so. In work area, the budget movie.
I didn't get the memo. I'm sorry. But
and they all eat at Chickadees.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So this place is actually based on TJ Fridays. And if there was another way to describe this movie, it's Pet Peeves the movie, because notice how every little thing from the printer that doesn't work to Joanna having to wear 15 pieces of flair is something that's become a thing, right? It's like, oh, this is my job, but this is the one part of my job that I just hate, that I despise. And in this case, it's like they force them to wear 15 pieces of flair to the point that TGI Fridays actually had to change their policy because people started making fun of TGI Fridays because oh, Tchotchkes is based on that. So yeah. Then there's Joanna, but then there's this other annoying guy that Keith mentioned, that his voice, and everybody has, like, as insane as it seems, you guys must have seen some waiter that does that exact same
voice. Too over the top, overly friendly, and yep. To the point where it's like it's almost like robotic or like scary. It's off-putting when they're overly friendly, and I think a lot of people have run into those people. They're trying way too hard.
Have you guys ever gone to a waiter or like sat down and a waiter tells you a story, but then you see that there's another family that gets sat somewhere else, and the waiter starts telling the exact same story in the exact same way? Because that's happened to me.
I don't think so.
To me specifically with a waiter, but I've seen it happen with I've seen another person do something similar, not specifically a waiter. Yeah.
I have family members whose stories I've heard about 45 times in my life, and I finish it for them sometimes.
You don't want to super kick them?
No, I don't want to hurt any member of my family. What have you heard?
I don't know. I'm just asking. Just like a little bit of wrestling. But, okay. So, Ryan, tell me, favorite scene or most memorable scene for you?
So, I think it's a combination of the breaking of the printer that they take it out in a field and they smash it. And then, of course, Samir doing his breakdance move. Those will always be my and that's kind of it's all within one kind of sequence, so I would say that's my favorite scene.
What do you think about that breakdance scene? We've talked about that for over a decade. I feel like whenever we mention the movie, like way before Cast of the Past, either you or me are contractually obligated to bring up that scene, right?
Yeah, it's just because it comes out of nowhere. I always talk about it with my friends, too. Like, we always joke about it. And we got a fun fact about it that will, when we get to the fun mm-hmm. facts, we can read. But it's just like, they're just sitting there doing whatever, like, dancing. They got some beers. And all of a sudden, Samir just, like, goes in front of the frame and just does this crazy move out of nowhere. It was just not expecting it.
It was a good level of dumb.
And it's just amazing where he's like singing the rap song at the end too. Like, it was just beautiful.
I have a question that kind of relates to those two scenes. Growing up, when you had your little iPod or your CD player or your tape recorder, depending on how far back it goes, did you have any music from that movie, like any of those rap songs, as a song from Office Space on there?
Of course.
Okay, I needed to know that about you. And now I'm going to judge you for it.
No, there's a lot of kind of classic rap songs in that. A lot of things that were like turned into memes and stuff, like the Die Mother Effer Die song was used a lot back in the YTMND like meme days. And a lot of people, because of this movie, had like the Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster song on their playlists and stuff. It is interesting that like it's an Office movie, but the soundtrack, they chose a lot of like rap songs just to make kind of similar to like a movie like Shaun of the Dead, where they had all these cuts to make mundane tasks look really badass. They definitely did something similar with like the hard disk, like downloading the virus or whatever. Like it's this big dramatic thing. And then afterwards they're like, slow-mo. Well, they were like, that was kind of easy because it's just like done.
The other character we got to bring up, Lawrence. Everybody wishes they had a cool, badass neighbor that could listen to every conversation through the Gibson board wall.
Also Oswald from the Drew Carey show.
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't unsee that at all.
because he's the same guy. Like, he plays the same role, and it's so good. But the fact that in one of the initial scenes, so Peter is alone in his apartment, but then Peter's like, well, just come on over, switches the channel, and there's some boobage on screen. And it's just the fact that he was so excited about that, he needed to go into Peter's house, change the channel. It's like, there's a boob. Literally, yep. I got nothing else to say other than I just wanted to point that out.
It's just one of those things. F&A, Peter.
But yeah, but I love Lawrence's character because he's kind of like the blue-collar counterpart where it's like, oh, you got the white-collar job and he's miserable, but it's like, oh, the blue-collar job, you know, it's a little bit more fulfilling. They don't deal with Case of the Mondays stuff. Like, you get your ass kicked saying something like that. So I think he's just kind of a good counter to Peter's life in a way, you know.
He is. He's there to build up to where Peter eventually gets to, where after all of this hypnosis, now they're on the exact same level. And God, I loved that line of, what would you do if you had $1 million? Well, two chicks at the same time. It's just so good. So out of nowhere.
And it's not even the line. It's that he leans forward. There's like this little pause. It's like, wait for it. Wait for it. Two chicks at the same time, man. Just so good. So good. And then the other two characters that come in, and they're sort of the plot twist. So we mentioned the downsizing that's going to be happening. And then that is actually the case. So we have two guys named Bob. One of them I know from Scrubs, John McGinley. I'm hoping I got that name right. I don't want to get two names wrong this episode. But it was hard to unsee him. As somebody that loves Scrubs, I've watched like every episode maybe like five times, except that last season, because that never existed. But I love the fact, and this is actually pretty true, as insane as it seems. So Peter has basically been skipping out of work because of the whole therapy thing, right? It's like he just doesn't care anymore. So then they're interviewing everybody to figure out like, hey, who are they going to cut? Who are they actually really good? And then Peter doesn't give a crap when he sits down. And then, but he's got so much swagger that they just go like, man, this is a big deal. And I feel like this is actually pretty true to life, where we sometimes overanalyze anything, that when somebody just comes in and is so chill and laid back, you're like, whoa, this is a somebody, because look at that swagger. Could you guys identify something like that?
Honestly, in the workplace, you'd be surprised what someone, like, charisma actually really goes a long way. If you are just a very likable person and are really good at communicating, and like I said, have charisma, that can actually take you further than actually being good at your job. So a lot of times you might see someone like an upper management and you're like, this guy sucks. How did he get that job? Well, you know, maybe he's just got that swagger or whatever. And then you see Samir and Michael, who they say they're basically the best programmers at the company, and they're going to get laid off.
Yeah, it's what RuPaul's Drag Race teaches you. You need charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
Never forget. I feel like this is the most important part of everything, because it's true. Like, when I think about like my personal career, I think that the first thing, I supervise and I give a lot of workshops, right? The first thing I'll say at any workshop, and in some ways, maybe I can actually credit Office Space, because I remember being inspired. And I apologize if there's a dog barking in the background. Such is life, right? But the first thing I say is, like, more so than what you say, it's how you do it. Because you can do your job fine, but if you do it in a really boring way, people are not going to think that you're working. Whereas if you're really like putting in personality, charisma, as Ryan mentioned, even if you're doing nothing at all, because like real talk, Peter even says it when he's first being interviewed. That's the key to life. He says like, oh, you know, when I first get to work, it's like I sit down and I do nothing. But it looks like I'm working. It really looks like I'm working. And I think that everybody listening to this at some point has become very good at looking like they're working. But they ain't doing sniffs. Ryan?
I will neither confirm nor deny those allegations. Well, I mean,
let's put it this way. You find yourself in situations where maybe you've done all your work, and it's like, okay, I could go and talk to someone and get more work, or I could just pretend like I'm still working and not get more work, you know?
So what you're telling me, Ryan, is that you're just not challenged enough as work. So at work. So mm-hmm. if we gave you some people to be under you, would that motivate you to have better performance?
Possibly. But I'll tell you what, right now, there's definitely no lack of work at my current job. In other jobs, I did find myself with sometimes I would have nothing to do because I was done. But it's actually a lot better to be busy at your job than to not be busy, because it's actually way more boring when you have nothing to do. Even if you are just like browsing Reddit or something, you'd almost rather be working because time will go by a lot faster.
I agree. But I'm always busy at my job. I'm a very hard worker.
I can't tell if you're being honest or not, Keith.
That's his PR answer. Right?
I'm not liking this to your boss. Which, how many bosses do you guys have? Because Peter has like 8 different bosses.
Oh, God. I don't even want to. Let's not talk about corporate structure.
Oh, man. No, you have no idea how significant this movie is. Like, at my personal job, even though I'm fairly young, I'm 29, I supervise a lot. And, like, I have a lot of responsibilities of people underneath me. So, like, the first thing that I try to always do is, I don't want to be the Lumberg. That is actually one of my inspirations. I told somebody at work one time, they did not believe me. And then, like, I was giving a workshop and I started quoting the movie, and the person was like, my God, you're actually at work here quoting Office Space. But nobody got the references, so I could just get away with it. No regrets. What is one thing that maybe doesn't quite hold up about the movie, whether it be technology, which we've talked about in the past, or just a scene or something?
The things that have been quoted to death, I found to be my least favorite parts of this movie. Like, the line's iconic, the, I believe you have my stapler. Like, to me, that was such a miss, just because I was looking at it from the point of, oh, that's where that's from. Okay. But just those things that have, to go back to my point of society, has really driven those things into the ground. I found those a little bit much of the movie. And the parts that haven't been beaten into the ground, I found to be quite enjoyable, to be honest.
Yeah, for me, I think it's just the technology is a little dated, but I don't think it takes away that much from the movie. Other than that, I feel like it's very applicable to today. It does nothing else really feels dated. Just when you see those big ass computer monitors and you see a hard disk or something, and the old like interface, that's the only thing that really seems a little dated. Other than that, I think it's perfectly fine.
When we get to the later part of the movie, the plan that they're doing, which is that they're gonna hack the system to have it take a couple of pennies, fractions of a penny, dare I say, a couple times a day, and then putting it to a bank account. But basically, Michael missed some kind of digits or decimals or something. And then when Peter checks his bank account, he's got over $300,000. So he knows, like, hey, we're screwed. They're going to find this out. And then he eventually wants to take the blame for it. But in that process, like, everybody starts hating him. They're going to go to federal pound me in the ass prison, which just I love that line so much. And the fact that the Peter actually dreams about that.
Yeah.
And Sabir, I love that line. It's so normal. Peter, you're a very bad person, Peter. Like, yeah. Oh, no, he did.
Yeah,
he called him a BP.
It is Dream. Like, Sameer and Michael have to go to federal prison, but then he just goes like, Peter, you know, you've lived a trite and meaningless life, and you are a very bad person. And that's all he gets. Like,
they could have so many curse words, but instead they choose to do a bad person. And I think,
yeah,
it's those little things that make this movie. And then what ends up happening is that because Milton keeps being told to move his desk and everything, sort of what Keith is talking about, you know, that Milton is sort of in the beginning of the movie, shows up a little bit in the middle, but then at the very end is when he really concludes. I mean, he's the guy that saves the day, you know, accidentally or not. He actually burns down Innitech.
It's quite the definition of saves the day.
Yeah.
Arson.
Peter actually laid a confession underneath Lumberg's door, immediately regrets it, but can't get it, right? So he's like, well, I'm done. You know, he had some problems with Joanne, which, okay, wow. I cannot get to the end of the movie without bringing up the O-face, Ryan. Okay, Ryan. Come on, Keith did the Milton. All right. Can you do the O face?
Oh, oh, oh. That's the best you'll get.
Such a dumb thing, and I now have a GIF of life. At twitter.com/acast a cast of the past. Make sure to submit on that on the YouTube version, which everybody can subscribe to. But it's the little things that he develops a relationship with Joanne, but the moment that he suspects that she was in a relationship with his boss, it's like this personal insult. Just a little thing, like quick reaction about that and how that unfolded.
Like, understandably so, because Lumberg's so repulsive, and then he has that dream where you're just like, nobody wants to see Lumberg getting it on the fact that he's got, like, he's got his coffee mug, and, like, he's sipping coffee in the middle of everything. It's great. And then, you know, of course, it turns out it was a totally different Lumberg, so Peter makes amends at the end.
Yeah, it was just a nice little point of this Lumberg guy is really destroying him in every way possible, just taking everything nice out of his life, whether it was true or not.
So then what ends up happening is, Peter's on the way to work, fully expecting to get arrested, but then the building is on fire. And in this case, I will give Keith credit where credit is due, where it shouldn't be obvious that Milton burnt out the building, but yet Peter immediately realizes or suspects that it is Milton, even though he's just between everybody. Then at the end, Milton's just sort of walking back, and Peter laughs there. Did you know, Keith, that was the conclusion of the movie movie before it happened?
I didn't. So I was just sitting there like, what the hell? Oh my God, that's a little extreme. And I had no idea that was coming, and I really enjoyed it.
What about you, Ryan? As somebody that knows what happens, do you think it's the proper way to go out?
I like it, just because even though Peter just kind of gets bailed out, I feel like he does kind of learn a lesson in the end. And he was going to do the right thing. He was just kind of given a saving grace. He was ready to accept his fate. And Milton, you know, just the other horrible things that the office was doing come back to bite them in the ass, basically. You know, they didn't even want to fire Milton. Like, he was on payroll as a glitch. He was laid off months ago. They decided, we fixed the glitch, but we're not going to even tell him. So, you know, you can, like, the Bobs have these terrible business practices, and they're supposed to be the consultants too, and they're the ones saying, like, yeah, damn, just stop Bobs. Paying him. We're not even going to tell him.
We fixed the glitch.
Yeah, exactly. So those things come back to bite them, and that bails out Peter and gives him kind of a second lease on life. So, you know, it's kind of like karma really kind of comes back for Inatech.
So then what ends up happening is that Peter seems like, you know, he has the relationship at the end of the movie, and then out of everything, he actually ends up working with Lawrence and just like cleaning, like construction work and things like that. And he's happy. So the moral of the story, more so than whether he liked working at Inatech or not, is that, hey, maybe...
just be happy.
Yeah, it's like, maybe this is the job that gives you money, but maybe you don't like it. And maybe you make less money doing another job, but you have more satisfaction.
Let me tell you, as a human being that has done exactly that, a career change in his life for less money and more happiness, I would do it 100 times over if I had the option or opportunity again. It's a good message at the end of this movie, one that everybody should consider.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think this movie actually really shaped how I kind of look at my career and my path forward, that you don't have to accept the position you're in right now as where you have to be. If you're unhappy in your position, you need to change it. Like, life doesn't have to be this way. You know, if you're miserable in a cubicle, you don't just accept it for the money. It's not worth it. You need to find what makes you happy.
But don't burn the place down in the process, love of God.
People, like, we're not advocating, if you don't like your job, set it on fire.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, I will say there is definitely something, now that I think of it, that reminds me of where it's probably a little dated, where kind of they're making, like, kind of joking references to, like, oh, they're so miserable, they would, like, shoot up the place. Like, You know,
ooh, yeah.
You wouldn't see that today. That's something where it's like...
That ain't Falco.
The culture has certainly changed where it's like you don't even joke about that stuff anymore, given like how, like the tension of today's climate, you know.
So I feel like there's only one logical question to leave at the end of the show, and it's not the legacy. It's about $1 million. Keith, what would you do if you had $1 million?
I'd invest half, buy a nice house, and open up my own business.
What would your business be about, buddy?
I don't know. No, you know what it would be? It'd be my barcade. I'd open up my barcade. That's what I'd do with $1 million. Yep.
What about you, Ryan?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Of course, yeah. Two chicks at the same time.
I think I would do something similar to Keith, except maybe I would try and do like try and open up a small like indie game company or something like that. You know, a couple employees that actually are talented and know how to make a game, and then I can be the idea guy. But definitely something like that. But first, like kind of use some of the money to just make sure I'm secure and have a place to live, and then you know, it'd be fun to make video games.
Yeah, for me, I think it'd be first to get a nice house, like maybe a house that can have a home office and like a studio or something like that. Like Keith, maybe invest in something and definitely have like a small company. I think that it's really easy to immediately want to think big and do something huge that ends up going bankrupt or something like that.
The sad truth is $1 million doesn't even go that far these days.
Yeah, no, exactly. Not a lot. So it's like just enough to get a startup going. Like just a startup. It's like that initial like $100,000 or something like that, and then hope that grows slowly rather than a bunch at the same time. So for everybody watching and listening, I send this question off to you. What would you do aside from two chicks at the same time? Because like we're talking about Lawrence here, so we just got to exclude that option because it is the one that we got in the movie. Not that there's anything wrong with that. What would you do if you had $1 million? Go to Twitter, a cast of the past. Instagram, acast of the past, @gmail.com, acast of the past, everywhere, pretty much. Now, we do want to quickly give a shout out before we get to a couple of quick trivia or unique facts about the movie. First up, we have a Ko-fi account. So if you like the podcast, if you want to support everything we do, ko-fi.com/acast of the past or acastofthepast.com/kofi, Ko-fi, not like Kingston, I'll keep saying it, is a pretty cool website that if you want to support the show, it's like buying us a cup of coffee. So you do that, we give you a shout out. One of the people that supported us is Amelia Highwind. So Amelia, you are pretty awesome. Thank you for supporting us. We also have an Apple Podcast review. So that's one of the best ways that we can increase our audience. If you leave a review, we will give you a shout out. So Keith, what is the review? You clearly don't have it right now.
I got it. Let me jump in.
Ryan.
Okay. So we get the review. Sorry, Keith. It was at the way bottom of the agenda. But we want to thank Enjoy7CA.
There it is.
Favorite new podcast. Glad these guys are back doing their thing. Nostalgia at its best. Can't wait to see what's to come. So thank you again. We appreciate the review. And seriously, those reviews do really help us out. They help us as far as like search visibility. So more people searching for movie and video game related podcasts can find us.
You know what I'd do with $1 million? Two thank yous at the same time.
Oh.
Ooh. So thank you.
Ooh, that's some good thank you. I want you to thank me like
some
that.
Very Keith. Generous thank yous.
Yeah.
They're not getting any of it beyond a thank you, but thank you.
Well, it's the thought that counts. So, Ryan, give us some interesting facts. I know that the first ones we got are from entertainment.ie.
Mm-hmm. So, first one, I think Vaughn touched on this, but I will read it again because I think there's a little bit more to dissect here. But he said Office Space was actually a box office flop, making only $12.2 million against a $10 million budget. Instead, the movie gained cult status and a sizable profit on video. So I'm sure at this point, the movie has more than made a ton more money since that initial $12.2 million just through video, DVD. It's now on Hulu. So if you guys haven't seen this movie, right now it is on Hulu for like no extra cost if you have a subscription.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yep. Looking at the next fun fact here, we got the prop department created the iconic red stapler of Office Space for the film. They needed a bright, noticeable color and chose red. After the film hit cinemas, Swingline began to receive requests from customers for red staplers. However, they had stopped offering the color for years. Thus, popular demand put red staplers back into production.
How crazy is that?
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, like it wasn't even in stock. Like there's no way that would happen nowadays. Like nowadays, they would tell the companies, hey, you better have a lot of this because like people are going to want to buy it. Here it's like, nope, we don't even have what you want to buy.
This is a very interesting one. The studio wanted Matt Damon as Peter, but Mike Judge felt the role should not have star energy. Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson auditioned for the role of Lawrence, while Ben Affleck was offered the role of Peter Gibbons additionally. Kate Hudson was considered to play Joanna.
I think that's a very good choice because the movie's about being mundane, just everyday.
Yeah, you don't want to be normal
things. Yeah, you don't want to be. You don't want to see Ben Affleck doing these mundane everyday things, because then it's just Ben Affleck in a situation opposed to a less known actor at the time.
Poor Ron Livingston's like, hey, we don't want any star power in the movie, so you got the role, buddy.
So. I'm going to butcher this name, but Ajay Naidu improvised, and this is Samir, improvised the moment when he breakdances in Peter's apartment since he had been breakdancing with friends in his downtime while shooting the film. So he just kind of improvised that out of nowhere.
That's movie magic at its finest.
Yeah, we got to put this in the film. And then also Paul Wilson ad-libbed the like naga naga not gonna work here anymore line that's in the movie as well, and that's credit to IMDb where we got that fact.
I love that because that's such a memorable line. It's so clever. You think it would have been written
out. You can't
believe
that wasn't in the script because it just seems so perfect with that scene. This last one also comes from IMDb. The PC load letter scene was not scripted. David Herman, who plays Michael Bolton, had more lines to say to Ron Livingston, who is Peter, but was interrupted by the photocopier jamming and didn't understand what it meant.
I love that as well because it doesn't... I think a lot of this movie has scenes that are just irrelevant, like the breakdancing scene. It doesn't add anything to the movie, but it's awesome. And same thing here. It's like they're talking. It's like PC load letter. What the hell does that mean? It's like it adds nothing to the movie other than ambience.
Yeah, it was perfect. Like it fits so well into the movie. You're shocked that it was like, again, wasn't part of the script because it seemed like it just so naturally happened.
Yeah, but guys, having watched Office Space again and in your case, Keith, having watched it for the first time, are you happy we got a chance to cover it? Would you say you want to check out more movies that are normal? You know, like one of my favorite movies also from Mike Judge is Idiocracy, which, dare I say, is a documentary about the future. That's not a comedy film. That's actually going to end up happening.
I've actually already seen Idiocracy, but that might be one to cover in the future for sure. I don't think I like it quite as much as Office Space. But definitely one I'd like to revisit. I like Mike Judge's kind of very subtle style of comedy, and would definitely be up for covering more of his stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though this is a situation that I've come off as kind of, like I would put it about like a 5 or 6 out of 10 as far as enjoyment goes. But a lot of Mike Judge's work I do enjoy. Like King of the Hill is one of my favorite comedies ever, but that's also from the lens of watching it growing up. So it could be a very similar situation as this from the other side. And maybe one day if we just keep plugging away at them, I'll find one of these normal movies, movies about normal things that I'll actually enjoy.
Something that I love to do, and I know it's scary when you talk about like King of the Hill or Simpsons, is I know we focus mostly on movies because we want to like cover like a complete thing. And I know like a season or a series is like next to impossible to summarize. But at some point, like if people could just suggest like a favorite episode or something for us to break down, like we can talk about a series, but it's like this episode of King of the Hill. I feel like, you know, we're wrestling fans. So when I think of The Simpsons, I would love to go back and check out that Bret Hart episode because people talk about it now, obviously, because of everything that's been going on recently. But it'd just be cool to just check out Popeye and Popeye accessories.
Dad.
Boomhauer, ma'am. So, Mr. McNulty, man, can you talk about some of the upcoming episodes on the Test of the Past, man? Can
you go into that, man? You did not just do that. All right. So, all right, what we got coming up? So, on May 5th, Keith is just perplexed right now. Okay.
Let's get to talking about the agenda, man.
Yeah. All right. Just don't do that. Anyway, May 5th, we're going to be covering Katamari Damacy. This was a poll. You guys voted for it. This is the game we will be covering. You'll be getting that review on May 5th.
Let's see how many Limp Bizkit jokes I fit into that episode, because there's going to be a few.
Wait, what? I'm really confused about that. Anyway, keep rolling.
Wait and see.
Okay, yeah, I get it. Okay, then, Keith, do you want to do this date, May 19th?
Oh, God.
Do you know what happened on that day? May 19th, they're all going to pay. And in this case, all means us, because we're going to sit down and watch the opposite of a cult classic, the movie See No Evil, a bit of a WWE meme that happened around the day May 19th. And
Keith, why?
This one's on me.
Why?
Well, see, here's the thing. May 19th happens on a Sunday once every 7 years. So if we don't do it now, then we're going to have to wait 7 years to do it. So let's strike while the old iron's hot.
Let's wait 7 years. Dude, yeah. I am so okay with waiting seven years.
And we should do it. And let's not forget to cover how WWE promoted this movie. We got to make
sure we touch
on that. And not
only that, but we need to make sure that we have a deep, in-depth discussion on the original idea for this movie. Vince McMahon's idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but anyway,
we'll get there then.
This is one of the first, if not the first, WWE Studios movie.
Because we had The Condemned, See No Evil.
I think See No Evil might have been the first. It was that or The Marine. But anyway, it's starring the actual mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee.
Glenn Jacobs, ladies and gentlemen.
And former / current, I don't even know at this point, WWE wrestler Kane.
Both, really.
And then
they never retire.
Yeah. Lastly, to finish off the upcoming episodes, we'll be doing another Off the Rails on May 26th. And that's usually once a month we like to cover let's catch up with what we're viewing in the world of entertainment that we may not otherwise cover on the podcast. So it's usually agenda free and we just kind of chit chat about, you know, the world of entertainment.
Yeah, it's just a good opportunity to catch up, as Ryan mentioned. So for those episodes, if everybody has questions or something like that, that's really the opportune time for us to get to that. So, you know, it's just a flexible agenda, so we can talk about that on another exciting episode of A Cast.
To the
past, boy, I tell you what.
Oh, well, we're going to say goodbye, man, now. We're going to end the show, man. We're going to end the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. Forget to subscribe, man. What's going to talk about? Talk about that.
Deborah, the power level.
What?
We're done.